Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, older women throughout American history. Today, it seems women of a certain age are having a moment. Think House Speaker Nancy Pelosi or Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'm 83 and doing this podcast. But if now is a good time to be an older woman, society has not always looked so kindly on our demographic. In fact, who we categorize as older and how we view them has shifted over time. New York Times op-ed columnist Gail Collins explores why in her new book titled No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. She joined me in the studio on Monday. Gail Collins, it's so good to have you with us.
Diane, it is so good to be here.
Our idea of how women have been thought of by society has really changed over the centuries. And you start out in colonial days. Talk about that.
I came as I was writing the book, No Stopping Us Now, was about what happened to women, older women, over American history, what things happened. And I came to think, well, the bottom line, a lot of it, is what is their economic role? If older women have a serious economic role in society, then they're looked at much differently than if they're just perceived as former mothers whose children have grown and gone away. And the colonial women created so much of the wealth for the family. They lived on farms. They did all of the candle making and butter churning.
Everything.
And bread making and whatever. And young women wanted to come and hang out with them because they wanted to learn how to do those things for their own families when they married. So it was a good time to be older, actually.
A good time to be older. And yet the country, as you point out, has gone through times when it wasn't so good to be older.
Oh, you know, you look at, say, the 1920s, which was when advertisers discovered for the very, very first time the idea of a youth market. And they were focusing everything on how to convince young people, especially the flappers, the young women of the moment, how, you know, to buy their stuff. The flappers became the stars of society. And movies came in. When you had theater, sort of older, large women were very popular as entertainers because you needed to be able to look at them from a long distance away. They had a lot of ability to orate and carry forth and large personalities. But then when movies came in, you wanted young women with no wrinkles whatsoever. And the obsession with being very young just was typified to me by the fact that the first Miss America, who was in the 1920s, was 16 years old.
I didn't realize that.
She was playing marbles with her friends behind the pageant. But that was the idea of what a perfect woman was at that point.
But then you move into the 1940s. You move into where women are not only important, they are absolutely necessary.
And it's a perfect example of when the economy needs you, then you're popular. Not only were men all gone to war, but younger women who had children really, really resisted the idea of going to work at that time. So the need for older women to show up and go to work was just intense. And suddenly you not only had Rosie the Riveter songs, you were celebrations of Josephine, the 80-year-old riveter, making bombs and bombers down south, and women, celebrations of women carrying trays in restaurants when they're 65 years old. I mean, I'm not sure that the women enjoyed it as much as the magazine writers like to pretend they did, but any job, they needed desperately women to do any job there was.
And so even older women were part of that.
Absolutely. Mostly older women because, as I said, the younger women who had children did not want to go back to work. So it was a desperate need that older women stepped right up and filled.
And after the war?
That was a bad period again. You not only had the war in it, you had the baby boomers were starting to sneak in after a while, and you had the creation of the suburbs, and this sort of vision of a suburb was a place where older people weren't. It was supposed to be young couples who were married, creating a new family, and there were lots of magazine articles warning people against letting their mothers move in with them under any circumstances whatsoever. So it was a very big moment for not being old, I would say.
I want to take you back to Sarah Josepha Hale. Tell us who she was and why she was so important.
Sarah Hale created magazines. She really came up with the idea of magazines for women. And she pretended that it was only just to encourage women to stay home more and that it was to celebrate womanly virtues, which would involve staying home, never getting involved in the outside world. She herself continued to work until she was in her 80s.
Ah.
She kept claiming she only worked because her husband had died and it was an emergency to feed her poor starving children. But the poor starving youngest child was 50 years old and she is still in there writing. But her vision of how you could celebrate women was simply to celebrate the woman at home. Woman at home, having her babies, the glorified housewife. Nothing is more wonderful and glorified than a housewife. And that means that anybody who's not being a housewife is sort of useless.
She wrote Godey's?
Godey's Ladies' Book, yes,
ladies
yes, yes,
book.
Yes, yes.
But didn't she also talk about clothing and how a woman should look?
She did. She also talked about what the house should look like. She was sort of the first one who produced all these ideal things,
yeah,
like how to have your dream house and what your dream house should entail and what to look like. And it was the first time, really, you got that kind of input from the outside world if you were a housewife. But suddenly you had all of these new charms and duties as a housewife to look this way, act this way. And it was supposed to be a celebration, but it was also part of the great cosmic putting women in a kind of a particular cage of roles that you couldn't get out of.
Boy, do I remember the advertisements on television about women next to their gleaming new stoves and washing machines and how important it was to use the right detergent.
Yes, yes.
And you still
the glory
see
for the housewife.
Yeah.
Although, you know, when I think about the housewife thing, too, I think about the 1930s, the radio soap operas, you know, the invention of the radio soap operas.
My Gal Sunday.
Yes.
And the romance of
Helen
Trent.
That shows you, for a woman of 35, romance and life need not be over.
Exactly.
And she was 35 for about 30 years. You know, she never got any older and she never got married. She never found her perfect suitor along the way. But it was that sense that you suddenly had this new thing, radio, which was supplanting movies to some degree. And a radio, you couldn't carry them around back then. During the day, the only people listening were housewives. So suddenly you had Ma Perkins, the soap opera about Ma Perkins, the middle-aged widow who ran a lumberyard, I think, but also, you know, stopped Nazis and saved people from train wrecks and did all kinds of other things. So it was a first point, I think, at which people thought, aha, somewhat older women, we can find a way to target them right now and they'll buy stuff from us.
Also, then came Betty Friedan.
Betty Friedan came along in the 60s and said, really spoke to a particular group of women, women in their 30s, basically, who were home, who had gone to college, who, you know, were told this was their perfect life to stay home and have babies and raise them, and then were getting bored out of their minds.
Exactly.
Or at least Betty certainly was. And she spoke to everyone. And I know so many women who read that book for the first time said, wow, I am not alone in these feelings. What does this mean? It was transformational.
So her influence really lasted for quite some time.
When she turned, I think it was 60, she was absolutely suicidal. She thought her life was over. This was terrible. Nothing was ever going to happen again. By the time she's 65, she's going to a disco to celebrate with all of her friends for her birthday. And she's preparing a book called Feminine Forever, which basically says, don't worry about the age thing. We're all going on forever, which really violently attacked anybody who didn't think you should be working at the age of 80. And it was just a complete transformation. She went from a 60-year-old, I'm going to shoot myself, I'm turning 60, to a 70-year-old saying, if I can't work when I'm 85, I'm going to go down, you know, and protest.
Throughout this book, No Stopping Us Now, is the issue of hair and color
yes.
of hair. Talk about the importance of hair color.
Well, my friend Nora Ephron used to say that the fact that women had overcome the challenges of age was not about feminism and it was not about better exercise. It was all about hair coloring. And once you could change the color of your hair so that gray didn't have to be there, then you could do so many other things. And it is true, there was like a 10-year period then, I think it was the 70s, when you begin the period, 7% of women are using hair coloring of some sort. And then it becomes so easy, very fast. And by the end, the government took hair color off passports because they could never quite tell what it was going to be when you got there. It was a quick transformation. Before that, back in the day, state legislatures kept threatening to pass laws against hair coloring because they thought it was an evil plot to trick men into marrying women who were older than they thought they were, which was the nutsiest thing ever, but that was state legislatures, you know.
You're sitting across the table from me, and you see I have allowed my hair to go absolutely white.
And that's a fashion statement, really. I mean, it's now very glamorous to do it because it's a choice.
We'll be back with more from Gail Collins after a short break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now here's the rest of my conversation with Gail Collins. She's an op-ed columnist at the New York Times. Her new book is titled No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. How does class play into this story?
Class plays into everything in one way or another. One of the things that I keep celebrating throughout the book, the idea of women being able to work later and later and later and have careers in the outside home. But then you have to always remember, too, there are a lot of women who are having to work later and later and later that don't want to at all.
Of course.
But they can't afford to live on their own. And there are so – your average woman is single at the end of her life. I mean, they become widows. They never got married. They get divorced. And trying to support herself if you're not – reasonably well off when you start this period is very, very difficult.
That was one of the criticisms made of Betty Friedan's book, was it not?
Yeah, she was totally about people like her. There were no African-American women in the book. There were no poor women in the book. It was a very narrow vision, but it was a vision that expanded, you know, all the time as it went on. And, you know, those women who, not just Betty Friedan, but the women who are never really particularly sung, who went out and filed lawsuits to get the right to be promoted, who staged protests at their businesses and fought for the things that Betty Friedan was talking about, the right to work and to continue to be employed and to continue to be promoted throughout your career. Those women, I know so many of them, and they didn't get the rewards for what they did because by the time they had succeeded, they were older. They had been stuck in jobs for a long time that weren't particularly respected. They had gotten everybody's face, so nobody wanted to particularly hang out with them if you were in management. And the people who got the rewards were people like me who came in the door then and got all the promotions and all the opportunities that they fought for. And I always like to point that out because I know so many of those women and they're not bitter about that. They don't sit around saying, you got my job, you got the things I was supposed to get. They're so happy. They celebrate the fact that this happened. They're so proud that they were part of it. And to me, that's the definition of a great heart right there.
You know, I recall doing this program that I was doing at the time in the 70s, a number of women who had been abused by their husbands, who were in very high positions of power in the government, and how they had to stay quiet because of that. Now we have this
Me Too movement.
And it's all coming out.
It's so true. And, you know, there's two ways of thinking about Me Too, that I, at least that I think about it. One is sort of celebratory in the fact that it was a response necessary because suddenly women were everywhere in the workplace. And men had not figured out how to adjust to that yet. But if women had stayed in their three or four different little positions that they had had, say, in the 40s and the 50s in an office where they were receptionists behind a typewriter, a steno pool, and nothing else, it was a lot easier to be protected in some ways because you were just off by yourself. Suddenly they're all over the place, and that's great. And there would have to be some moment at which that adjustment had to happen and men had to be reminded, taught, explained to how to relate to women who are working with them on those levels. And beyond that, just for me, I see guys coming along now, and it's educated them. It's brought them into a new place in their own lives. And it's just the best thing that's happened that I can think of.
And you think about the fact that when my first child was born in 1960, my husband was so involved with his career, he never changed a diaper, he never pushed a carriage. And now you look and you see all these men involved.
It's also great in that now men are so involved with their children that they take paternity leaves. So when you're a business and you're hiring someone, just because she's a woman, you're not going to necessarily think, well, I might lose her for a maternity leave, because the guys are going to go too. And that's that evens everything out on 57 different levels.
Tell me about the wives of presidents and how they enter into this story.
Can I tell you about Martha Washington? She
Please.
Really knocks me out. It so alarms audiences when I suddenly say, I've got to tell you about Martha Washington. This is so amazing. But Martha was married before George, and she had two children, and when her husband died, she ran the family business until George came along. She married him. They used her money to update Mount Vernon.
Yep.
And then it became a place that George could use to entertain all the multitudinous numbers of people that you have to entertain if you're a man at the center of the political and public universe. And so Martha would often have, she had about an average of 300 guests a year, I think I remember. And some of them would stay for a month or two.
Wow.
So she's running this massive hotel, basically. And at the end of the evening, after everybody's been fed and taken care of, she has to entertain everybody because George sneaks off to his study and leaves her to do all the entertaining, which she did apparently very well. There was a letter from one senator who said he had such a great time talking with Martha. And he said, if this continues, I believe that someday I may actually be willing to deal with the prospect of talking to old ladies. And at the time, she is 60 and he's 58. So excuse me. But the thing about Martha, and then she went and she was like a Spartan mother to the Revolutionary Forces. She was at Valley Forge. She just had this amazing life in support of the new world, the new world that George was helping to create. And when the time came to celebrate, they never had any children, though. She was not a mother to George Washington's children. And when the time came to celebrate the woman in George Washington's life, all the articles were about George Washington's mother, who he didn't even like. But she was the mother, and Martha, vis-a-vis George, was not a mother. So all the things she did were just completely overlooked in favor of that mother connection.
What a story. Now jump forward to Eleanor Roosevelt and to Bess Truman and to Mamie Eisenhower.
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt had, I think, possibly the most amazing middle age of any woman in the history of the United States. She was 48 when she came into the White House, and she traveled by herself. She went off to see poor black people in their towns, poor people in Appalachia, people that nobody in the government ever bothered to check on before or talk to or listen to. And she did it often by herself. It drove the Secret Service crazy that she kept going driving off by herself. And they finally taught her how to use a pistol. So I sort of love the idea of her driving around with her pistol. Well, I just love that part. But she went, of course, overseas when the war started. She went to the Pacific to see, you know, the wounded soldiers there. She just kept going and going and going and going. I think there's been nobody like that ever until now in our history. That one particular role that she took and turned into something transformative, really.
And Bess Truman.
Bess Truman didn't do that.
To say the least.
She was into the very solid mother stays home, has child. And Mamie Eisenhower was of that role, but she moved it into kind of a new level. She was a public person. She really, without being political in any particular way, but she really loved to go and talk to crowds. She was used as a campaign tool, you know, vote for Ike and keep Mamie in the White House. She was very popular. And she was sort of a fashion icon in her own way.
Clothes.
She loved clothing. And she also was very open about her physical affection for Ike, which had not ever come up before, the idea that, you know, the first lady would actually show physical affection, kissing and hugging her husband, was something you didn't talk about before, but she did it.
Jump to Gloria Steinem and what role she represented, not only to single women, but to married women as well.
One of the useful things in the book is that you can do the decades by Gloria Steinem, because she famously, when she turned 40, had a little party and someone said, "You don't look 40." And she said, "This is what 40 looks like."
Exactly.
And then it became, "This is what 50 looks like." Nobody ever at 40 looked like Gloria Steinem, I have to say. But her point was well made. And she just kept on doing it. And she was, of course, central to the women's movement. She was important, I think, to a lot of younger women in that without ever talking about it or dealing with it and just being crazy whenever you mentioned it, she did show younger women that you could be a very attractive woman and still be right in the middle of the fight for women's rights, which had been sort of an iffy question, I think, for a lot of younger women coming up right at the beginning. And she was sort of, because she never thought about it, she never talked about it, but yet she was so incredibly attractive and had such an active romantic life that she kind of made things cool for younger women who might not have easily have figured it out without that.
And she finally married.
She did, and then her husband died very, very quickly. And I talked to her at her 80th birthday. But she, of all the people I talked to, she's the only one who's ever said this. She said one of the things she likes about getting older and hitting her 70s and then her 80s is that you no longer have to have physical affection with men, that you can just meet a guy and have a nice talk and never be thinking about
exactly
what's going to happen next. Now, a lot of other women of her age that I've talked to do not feel that way at all and feel that, you know, sexual relations is a very important part of their lives. But Gloria, who had so many wonderful romances, seems to really feel that this is a liberating factor.
Now, I've got to turn to politics, Gail, because you do write this wonderful column for the New
Thank
York
you.
Times. What did you make of President Trump's response this weekend to the killing of the Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi?
It was the normal Donald Trump thing. It was all about him. And, you know, you sort of compare it to when the same thing happened when Barack Obama was president. And it was sort of a very measured, sad talking about the lives lost, celebrating the people who had done the fighting, who had done this thing. And he kept saying "we" as if he had somehow been out there doing part of the fighting.
He said it was like watching a movie.
Yes, it was very Donald Trump, I'd say.
What do you think about the fact that Nancy Pelosi and other Democratic leaders were not informed of the attack on this leader?
Well, it was very wrong, but what, you know, this is a president who doesn't do anything according to any tradition or protocol except the ones that he likes for himself. And you just hope, you know, I've never appreciated you know, somebody like Mitt Romney, who I used to make fun of all the time because of his dog on the roof of the car and stuff. But anyway, I never appreciated people like him before, people that I disagreed with politically, but who I knew believed in the same sort of way you go about political lives and go about leading a country. And I miss that a lot.
How much trouble do you think he's in over the impeachment process?
Wow, I've never been through anything like this. I would certainly be worried to death if I was Donald Trump about what was going to be happening next. I'm worried what will happen just because he's there.
Are you worried for the country as well?
Sure. I mean, you always worry for the country when something destabilizing happens. We're in a whole new world now that I didn't appreciate. The effect of the internet and web communications until, I think, Trump was elected, and you suddenly see that things are going to be different from now on in politics and in much of our lives, and you don't quite know how yet, but it's scary.
Are you concerned about the Democratic candidates for president?
Well, I can say one thing. If we go back to my theme of older women in America, we have three candidates 70 or above in the Democratic primaries, and the only one whose age doesn't get talked about is the woman, which is, I just knocks me out, Elizabeth Warren. You do not hear people talking very much about Elizabeth Warren. Is she too old? I mean, because she's such a busy beaver running around doing all this stuff all the time. Whereas Joe Biden, it's a very serious issue. Bernie Sanders, it's a very serious issue. So to me, that's I mean, it's a detail, but it's I really like it, I got to tell you.
Are you concerned about Joe Biden and his performance during those debates thus far?
You know how long this campaign is going to be just for the nomination. It's going to go on for a long time. It's very exhausting for everybody involved. And I'm confident that we'll know what Joe Biden's capacity to push on at that level of engagement and effort and exhaustion for a long period of time is.
And you have another candidate who has just had a heart attack.
Yeah, yeah. And on the other hand, we got a 37-year-old guy who complains that we're trying to discriminate against him because he's too young. So the age thing is all over the place.
Do you think there's any possibility next year that Democrats will nominate a woman?
Sure. Elizabeth Warren is at the head of many of the polls right now. And it depends on how she and her competitors do. But it's certainly possible. Heavens, yeah.
Do you think that the country is now more ready to vote for a woman than they weren't in the last election?
I always thought that the greatest achievement, perhaps, of Hillary Clinton's life is that she got the country used to the idea of women running for even the highest office in the land. And she did. And so things are different.
Gail Collins, what a great pleasure to talk with you.
So good to be here.
Thank you. And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher, Josephine Neonai, and Natalie Uriblipker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.